My name is Charles Lutz. I've been coming to Holden for, ever since 1965. I think this is the eighth or ninth trip, but it's the first time I've been here other than at summertime. And so it's a new kind of experience for Hertha and myself, and it's delightful. Lots of new snow and no wind. I don't know if there's ever wind here in the winter, but it's nice and it's bright and it's very pleasant. What I agreed to talk about a little bit with you tonight is the relationship between Lent and compassion as it relates to the world of politics or the world of ordering human society. And so the title that I've used when asked to give a title for this was Lent and Compassion Can Get You in Trouble. I want to start, though, by reminding us all that this isn't yet Lent. Lent this year is about a month away. I think it starts in early March this year. But we're on the day of the church's traditional calendar when there's a kind of bridge between Christmas and Lent. At least that's the way this day has historically been understood. You all know, I suppose, if you're Americans, that it's Groundhog Day. But way back before Groundhog Day, this was known as something else. Does anybody remember what the 2nd of February in the church's calendar is? It's not the biggest day in the church year, obviously. In fact, it's one of the very, very minor days. But I think if you're interested in that sort of thing, and I am, I think it's worth talking about. This, in British or English tradition, has been called Candlemas. The Mass of Candles. But behind that, it's really the day that recognizes and recalls annually the day of the presentation of our Lord in the temple. So it's sometimes called the Feast of the Presentation. One of the texts for that day is the Song of Simeon, in which he talks about Jesus being a light to lighten the Gentiles. And it's apparently from that text and that tradition of the light to the world that Jesus is, and the light to lighten the Gentiles, that there came the tradition of blessing the candles for the whole year on this day, Candlemas, February 2nd. It's also 40 days after Christmas, and in some traditions, at least early on, Christmas was observed for 40 days, not 12 days, as we sometimes do it, or one day, or end with the end of Advent, the way some American Protestants seem to end Christmas. Christmas was a 40-day season, as Lent is a 40-day season. And so this marked the end of Christmas in that tradition, and the beginning of the look ahead toward Lent. And in some years, of course, Lent begins this early. So that's where we are. How did it get to be known as Groundhog Day? The speculation is that Candlemas, traditionally in Europe, was a good day for forecasting the weather for the rest of the year, the rest of the winter and into the spring. And out of that, in American culture, came the tradition of Groundhog Day. And I don't know why the groundhog. I don't know that much about it. But that supposedly is why Groundhog Day coincides within the church's calendar, Candlemas, or the Feast of the Presentation of our Lord in the temple. From that, I want to move into some discussion of Lent and 40-ness. I've been fascinated by the fact that I knew from early on, from my father's teaching, my dad was a pastor, that Lent, if you don't count the Sundays, which are little Easters and therefore not part of Lent, Lent is 40 days long. And you can count it up for yourself. You have to take my word. You don't have to take my word for it. You can count it. But I think it's correct that Lent is 40 days long without the Sundays, which don't count because they're little Easters. They're celebrations of the resurrection. So what about Lent and 40-ness? Well, 40 in the Bible, as you probably have discovered if you're any kind of student of the Bible, is a symbolic number for a long time. Whether it's 40 days or 40 years, 40-ness represents a long period of time. And it's kind of a round number that symbolizes, without being too literal about it, symbolizes a lengthy period of time. I think you can remember some of the 40s in the Bible that are quite well known. Let's tick them off. What do you remember about 40? 40 years of wandering in the wilderness for the people of Israel. Right. What else?
40 years of Moses' life, 40 years of young man, 40 years the leader of the people, 40 years in the desert.
Adding up to 120, yeah.
40 days and nights of the flood.
Right, Noah and the flood and the 40 days and nights of rain. Yeah, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Yeah. What other 40s occur to you?
40 days of temptation or 30?
40. Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, his testing, was 40 days. What else? Can you think of any others? There are some others that are somewhat more obscure, but those are the main ones. Well, the tradition is that the church in establishing Lent as a 40-day period was echoing that biblical tradition of 40-ness. 40-ness biblically means a time of testing, a time of endurance, or when endurance is tested, a time of suffering to some extent, and usually a time of preparation for something. Jesus' 40 days of testing in the wilderness was a time preparing Jesus for ministry. So 40 equals a long time. It's symbolic more than literal. And Lent picks that up with the 40 days, not counting the Sundays. There's another old tradition that for 40 hours we observe from Good Friday to Easter sunrise. That's a 40-hour period of special attention and reflection on the suffering and death and approaching resurrection of our Lord. So there's another 40. Lent is a time, of course, when we do focus on the passion of Jesus. The suffering is what passion means, the suffering of Christ. Now, the word compassion obviously means suffering with. That's literally what compassion is. It is suffering with another. I think sometimes the word compassion in our culture or in our vocabulary and use of language seems like a soft word. I want to suggest tonight that it's a hard word. Jesus in the Gospels is often said to have compassion for the people. Lent is a reminder of that, of our Lord's compassion. It's a reminder of our call to be compassionate ones who follow Jesus. It is not essentially a soft word. It is not an easy kind of discipleship to be compassionate. It is hard for Jesus, and it is hard, I think, in its call to us. Compassion is in the category of grace, not the category of law. And grace is always capable of giving offense, because people say grace is not fair, it is not just, and they're right. God, the compassionate one, is so accused. The picture of God painted often by Jesus, think of the parable of the forgiving father, often called the parable of the prodigal son, or the parable of the late workers in the vineyard. Those are parables that are assumed to be about the way God is, and they are about grace, therefore, but they also give offense to people. They turn people off. People say it's not fair. It is not fair for the father to forgive the younger brother who returns after wasting the inheritance, wasting the family's goods, and then comes back and is forgiven. The elder brother doesn't think that's right. Or the parable of the late workers in the vineyard who are paid the same as those who labored through the heat of the day. Those who labored through the heat of the day say what about that? Are they happy for their fellows? No. It's not fair, they say. It's not just. I think that's a parable also of grace, and therefore of the way God deals with us. Grace gives offense because it is not viewed as justice, and indeed it is not justice. Jesus, as the one who befriends sinners, eating with the non-respectable people of his time, he is accused by others as as one who is insensitive, not doing what a religious leader ought to do, not respecting the holy ones, the righteous ones, but eating and drinking with sinners. So you have that tension between grace and justice, or grace and law, going on when you talk about and think about and act about compassion. Compassion illustrates the tension. We all of us have some expectation of justice for ourselves. We would like to be treated justly, although I would caution us not to expect to be treated justly by God, because that would mean our death. We don't really want justice from God, because we would die. We want mercy from God. But we have some sense of justice in human relationships, and we have some expectation of justice. We want to be treated fairly. But we all also have a need for grace or mercy as well. And we need from God and from each other more than just justice. Justice alone is not enough. We would die without mercy and grace added to justice. So, a human society also needs more than just justice. We never attain justice fully, but we also need more than justice. We need mercy. How to mix the two is always a political question. Let me give you one example out of rather recent memory. Some of us, at least, will remember this far back. Toward the end of the Vietnam War, there was talk in our society about giving amnesty for those who, for whatever reason, refused to serve, refused to bear arms. Now, amnesty is a kind of legal grace. The law does not have to do amnesty ever, but it can choose to do it. A society can choose to do amnesty for social reasons, for social good. After the Civil War, there were various kinds of amnesty extended by primarily by Abraham Lincoln. It was his plan, at least, to do amnesty for the South and its leaders. And with very few exceptions, the military and political leaders of the South were given amnesty. Why? Not because they deserved it, as the North viewed it, but because the society needed it to heal itself. And usually amnesties are done for such political reasons, to heal a society and get on with the business of living together in a social order. Amnesties have very little to do with what is just. They have a lot to do with what is merciful and what is healing. So it was at the end of the Vietnam War, but there was a great debate about it. There was controversy about it. You'll remember that many people said, hey, wait a minute, to do amnesty for those guys who refused to serve, even if they were following their own conscientious inclinations, would not be fair to those who also had questions about the war but went and served. And they were absolutely right. It would not be fair to them. Amnesty is not about fairness, treating everybody fairly. It is about other things like mercy and healing. Well, we eventually, at the beginning of Jimmy Carter's administration, did a kind of general amnesty for draft resistors who had gone, some of them into exile, some of them were still in prison. They were pardoned. They were given amnesty. And we soon forgot about that issue and got on, and I don't think to this day too many people are troubled about that. But it was very hot and controversial for a time. Is it a wise thing politically to do that? Well, let me bring us down to the present moment, and I'll suggest a couple other examples that I think are equally political and that have to do with a society trying to be compassionate and with people in the name of their Lord trying to be compassionate. And I'm thinking of the way we relate to refugees. Whether you think about legal refugees, that is, refugees who are viewed by our government as here legally or eligible to be brought here legally, or whether you think about undocumented persons who are viewed by our government as not legal in this society, in this country. Either way, you can get in trouble with others for extending a compassionate hand to refugees. legal refugees, and the debate continues about who should be admitted legally and what, in what numbers and what kinds of people. Legal refugees, if you admit them, it always means, I think, that it's at the expense of someone else. It's at somebody else's expense. In other words, not everybody can be admitted, so you make some judgments as a society about who should be admitted and in what numbers. Secondly, once they get here, they almost always are viewed by somebody as being here at that somebody's expense. I remember a few, not too many years ago, maybe 6-8 years ago now, there was a major uprising down in the Gulf of Texas by shrimp fishermen who were offended because the new refugees from Vietnam, from Southeast Asia, were moving in on their livelihood and were also shrimp fishermen and were doing it the wrong way and were doing it more cheaply, and they were economic threats to the shrimp fishermen who were already there. And I expect there are other examples of that too, how refugees are always a threat to somebody's economy and economic well-being. And I'm talking about legal refugees. Certainly, if you talk about those who are here and not documented, and the response to them in ministry by people of the church primarily, it's almost exclusively where their response has come from, that response gives offense. It gives offense to our law, to our society's understanding of what is right and just and fair, and it gives offense to people apart from that question who say you ought not provide sanctuary or any kind of care for people who aren't legally in this country. So ministry of that kind, which we would say is a compassionate response, I think those who believe in it would say that, not everybody sees it as a simple, nice, good thing to do. Some people see it as an offensive thing that is going on. And so that's the nature, it seems to me, of compassion. Compassion is always viewed by somebody else who is not on the receiving end of it as a questionable thing, a bad thing, not in their interest, and at the very least, not a just thing to do, because grace or mercy and its extension is not basically about justice. I think you can talk in terms of the welfare system and welfare reform and see similar kinds of things going on. Who are the deserving poor and who are not deserving? That always comes up. That's a justice question. Who deserves certain things from the rest of us who are taxpayers, or who does not deserve certain things? Joan was reminding me a few minutes ago when we were talking about this theme for tonight, the fact that you can get in trouble trying to be compassionate, that one of the Berrigans once said during the Vietnam War days that if you want to follow Jesus, you had better look good on wood. So I will stop there and invite your conversation about any or all of this, from the 40 days or Candlemas right down to the politics of compassion. Yes, Joan.
I would find it helpful if you would define how you're using the word justice, and if in fact you think that the way it is used in our society is the way the Bible uses that word.
I don't think they're identical, the way it's used in our society and the way it's used biblically. But I think in both cases, it is a concept or a category that is distinguishable from grace. Justice is basically not about grace. Justice is about what people have a right to expect in terms of relationship with God, or the Bible's understanding of right relationships among people. It is about what you have a right to expect if things are going as they ought, if things are full of shalom, if things are following God's will, God's intention. In human society, human secular understandings as well, I think it's essentially about that. We use the word entitlement today. That's a word that fits with justice. What I'm entitled to is part of what is just for me in society. John Rawls, in A Theory of Justice, a very long and heavy book, I think, but Some of it I can understand. He's a philosopher of justice. John Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, says, and this is what I find most helpful about Rawls, the way to imagine a just human society, the way to design one, is to think of yourself as one who is among the weakest in that theoretical society. You don't know if you'll be male or female, and it's a sexist society, so you have to assume the worst. Assume you'll be a woman, according to our understanding. You don't know if it's a racist society, so assume the worst. In our understanding, that means you're not a European person of background. You're a person of color. It's a society that doesn't value old age, so assume that you're elderly. It's a society that doesn't put much value on children, so assume you're a child. It's a society that doesn't value people with disabilities, so assume you are disabled. Okay, now, what kind of society would you structure if any of those or all of those things are true about you? What kind of, to make sure that your self-interest is met, what kind of society would you design? Well, that isn't very far, it seems to me, from the way some of our recent politicians have talked. Hubert Humphrey talked a great deal about the humane and just society being one that takes care of its least able to compete, its most vulnerable people. That's a humane society. Or Franklin Roosevelt talked that same way about the poor. A society that is considerate of its poorest people is a just society. And I think it's not far from the biblical understanding that we ought to seek for our neighbor what we seek for ourselves. I think it's akin, Rawls' approach to this, is akin to love your neighbor as you love yourself. It doesn't say instead of yourself. In other words, there's some, if you want to fashion a just society, fashion one that would meet your self-interest if you were among the most marginalized of people. But see, all of that talk, that kind of talk about justice, whether it's biblical or not, talks about seeing that my needs are met, seeing that the needs of everybody are met. And it's therefore about expectations and entitlements and being treated fairly. And I don't think grace is about that at all. Grace is about what is not deserved or entitled or can be expected. It's always about what cannot be expected but is given anyway. And I think, as I've been playing around with the history of this place, what strikes me over and over again is how Holden is a gift. The giftness of Holden is just key. From its very beginning, it is a gift. Without any expectation or any deserving or merit or earning, and without any condition, Holden was a gift from the beginning, and I think still is. Joan, did you want, or Barbara wanted to pursue it?
Well, Chuck, I've never heard you talk so sort of negatively about justice. Don't you think...
Oh, I'm not negative about justice,
okay,
Barbara.
But I mean, isn't there a sense in which all of our sort of church and public policy work is to try to help people see that... it sounds to me like you're equating grace sort of with charity, kind of, and that there's no really just claim that the poor have on us, or the refugees have on us as a nation. Because I think there really are ways in which... refugees don't just have to throw themselves at our mercy or other marginalized people, but rather can appeal to justice, that it's unfair the way the world is structured. Mm-hmm. And according to the Bible, that's a justice issue, not a compassion issue, not a grace issue, but it's rather a question of...
I'd agree with everything you've said. I have no problem with the category of justice being applied to the people of the developing world in terms of how the world's goods are divided up. I think that's a justice issue. Refugees, I think, have a just claim on those who can take them in. But I don't think, in terms of human law, refugees are ever viewed that way. They're always viewed as people that a nation will take in if it feels like it. Not all nations take in refugees. My basic point, and if it came across as putting down justice, I don't want to do that. My basic point is compassion is more related to grace and mercy than it is to justice. compassion, I think, is something we do not have to do. As soon as we have to do it, which justice requires us to do, it is no longer compassion. As soon as God has to do grace, you know, as soon as you say, God, to be just to me, you have to be merciful to me, we've taken away some of the essence of what mercy is. And in fact, you can't press it too hard because it's not all that clean. Responding with a ministry to refugees or anybody else who's in need is neither one nor the other exclusively. It's both and. But for the sake of making the point about compassion that I wanted to make, I would argue that compassion is essentially grace and not justice. Well, there are elements of justice with it.
Okay, but wouldn't you say, like, on the refugee issues, that it's much more effective working with public policy? I mean, that we shouldn't just say, let's allow Central Americans to remain in our country, for example, because we're a merciful nation, but rather there is a just claim. I mean, that in advocating with the government, we should use the justice rather than the compassion argument.
I think you have to use both arguments to pursue it on the public policy debate, as I think you do for foreign aid, let's say. A more legitimate assistance to the developing nations from the U.S. Treasury. I think you have to press two buttons. You have to press the button of, this is something we should do because it's in the best traditions of America to be generous. We've been blessed. We can share more. And it's in our own self-interest as a justice issue. I think you have to press both those buttons in the public policy arena. And I think the same is true with refugees. I don't think either one alone will get you where you want to go with the public policy debate. I don't think it'll get the legislation adopted. But in terms of the response of Christian people, I think, I suppose you still have to talk both ways, but I think it's essentially, if it's compassion that we're talking about, it's essentially a matter of grace and mercy and not of justice. Yeah.
Barbara's comment suggests to me that there is quite a difference between biblical justice on one hand and justice as it's viewed in a nation by constitutional law or legislation,
yeah,
or so on and so forth. They're two different things.
Yeah. I think that's true. Some, I can't remember who it is now, who's written about that and has said that in our Western understanding of justice, justice is depicted as a blind lady, a lady with blindfolds on, who's holding the scales. We've all seen that image. In biblical understanding of justice, the question would be raised, who's got whose thumb on the scales? So you take off the blindfold. And that also in biblical understanding of justice, it's not a simple giving each what his or her need is. It's a tilt toward the most marginalized, always. In terms of getting right relationships established, it's always a tilt toward the poor, toward the refugee or sojourner, toward the orphan, toward the stranger. It's a biased kind of approach. It's a preferential option for the poor in biblical understanding of justice. But in Western secular understanding, that is not the case. So, yeah, I think there is a difference. But it's still about, I think, what they have in common is justice is about what I can legitimately expect, what is merited, what I have a right to, what I'm entitled to. It's about that. And I don't think grace is about that at all. I think that's where they separate. Yeah?
I certainly agree that grace and justice are not the same. I'm not sure if I would agree with you that compassion is primarily grace.
Okay.
I think that certainly there are times that when we have compassion on someone that we do forgive and we do essentially respond out of a sense of grace and not out of a sense of what people deserve or what we would expect. But I guess for me, in my own experience, many of the times that I feel like I have have come to some point of compassion is when I have understood the injustices that certain people have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
That my main reason for being compassionate is because I have come to realize sometimes very subtle factors in their lives that I never was aware of before. And it was only when I started seeing their lives in terms of justice or injustice that I became compassionate about their situation. It wasn't a matter of being responding to them just because I was felt sorry for them.
Yeah.
It was more of an understanding of the system and an understanding of what they did have a right to expect and that they weren't getting that.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be what I guess I would see as a sense of compassion.
Would you say then that no one can have compassion unless they understand?
No, I'm not saying that.
I wouldn't either.
I'm saying that I think that there are also times that we do have compassion for someone, even with an understanding. But I guess for me, there's also a sense of compassion because of some revelation of understanding of what's going on in the world and being compassionate for those people who are the ones that get caught and trapped at the bottom.
I think that's really in the word itself. Compassion is suffer with, to suffer with. And you've just said it. You, in a sense, have to suffer with, and that's different from pity, I think. Pity and feeling sorry for are different from compassion. Compassion means to suffer with another. And to really suffer with another means you're led, even if it's vicarious, into the suffering that person endures, and to understand it. In a way, at least, and then
I understand their suffering, but I can at least start to.
You can empathize, And I don't want to suggest that there's no element of justice in it. I think there is. I think that which gives offense in compassionate response to the needs of others is usually not the justice side, but the mercy side. Because people almost always say, it isn't fair. And I just want to say that I agree with them. It isn't fair. That kind of response, in one sense, is unfair to somebody else. And so be it. You run that risk. There is no way, I think, to do compassion and be fair to everybody. But that's not the highest value, being fair to everybody, I think. Yeah.
Reflecting upon compassion and justice, to be focused solely on justice could lead, in a sense, to a point of despair when that justice could never be brought about. Where, in a sense, compassion, to me, almost a sense of going to suffer with, and pursuing compassion, be compassionate without a sense of expectation or anticipation of really, there being an end to it, a resolve to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like as Christians that we need to be that compassion needs to be there for us to at least there's a paradox about it that we can suffer with and that there is a hope there or something.
I think it's true that we need both because each in a sense is more than the other. Justice, in one sense, is more than grace or mercy or charity, because once it is written into the system, you have a right to demand it. And you can never demand grace or mercy or charity. That's freely given. And if somebody decides not to give it anymore, you can't say, I have a right to it, because you don't have a right to it if it's grace. On the other hand, I think grace is more than justice, which is always incomplete, and it's sort of extra mile. The Roman soldier asks you to walk, carry his armor 1 mile, walk the second mile with him. That's beyond the requirements. Grace is like that. I think compassion is also like that. It goes the second mile. It goes beyond what we are simply required to do. So each is more than the other, I think, in a kind of paradoxical sense. And therefore, we need both. We need both from God. We need both from each other. And I think a society needs both.
Well,
both mercy and justice. He needs to strive toward both. There was another hand up here somewhere.
I'm struggling with justice in terms of maybe put it kind of radically. Justice is a farce.
A farce?
Yeah, in this world.
Yeah. Because our approximations of it fall so far short of true justice. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, or even the ability of sinful human society or human beings, including myself, to be that.
Yeah.
And so I guess I want to struggle with what is the difference between the biblical meaning of justice and justice in sort of the mindset of society. What is that difference? And then what is the Christian responsibility to bring the reality of biblical justice to bear in its time and society? So I guess I'll ask you to struggle with me a little bit more in terms of the difference between our understanding of, you know, justice and the biblical faith and justice in the contemporary society view of what it is. Or is there that much distinction? Our text for last Sunday, Old Testament text, was, you know, do justice, love kindness,
and walk humbly with God. Yeah.
And although the reading I did suggested that the biblical sense of justice was not just a concern for fairness, but a doing things for those for whom life was unjust. So it was an action. The only way you really do justice is to be working for those at the periphery. You know, to bring about more fairness, in a sense.
Yeah.
But that it is not a term which suggests that equality is even possible. But that when you're doing justice, you're at work to alleviate those for whom the inequalities are most predominant. Now, am I misunderstanding?
Well, I think biblical justice is about right relationships, first of all, rather than a kind of static or academic definition of fairness. It's about right relationships. And the right kind of relationship between the society as a whole and those who are most marginalized or most vulnerable is to bend over backwards to give them what they need to live. So the widow, the orphan, the exile, those three categories typically are mentioned in the Old Testament a great deal, and the poor. But the widow and the orphan were usually poor too. That was the definition of being poor, if you were a widow or orphan. And the understanding of justice in that context was dynamic and moving. It wasn't static. And it didn't have much to do with the courts. Most Americans, if you just ask them on the street to freely associate words with justice, will probably come up with crime and criminal justice and the court system and lawyers and legal system. And I don't think that's central to the Bible at all in terms of justice. And it isn't central to some other societies today either, because it's primarily Western and European-oriented societies that have our understanding of justice, kind of out of a Greek tradition and heavy dependence on attorneys and courts. Maybe somebody else wants to get in here, this discussion of what is justice. Everybody wants justice, but it's very hard to define what justice is, I think. There are many definitions of justice.
But you see, in a sense, our interpretation, in other words, what you said, that I as a Christian or the Christian church, doing justice today in the biblical sense is actively in relationship of doing things to alleviate people at the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Today in society, society, the average Joe interprets that as mercy, not justice.
I think that's true. I think what the citizen of the United States, as a citizen only, would say is, we are not required by justice to admit people to this country who want to get in. That we're not required to do that. We do it. That's second mile. It's beyond the call of what we're required to do. We aren't required to share our wealth with the developing countries. If we choose to do it, it's grace, it's mercy, charity. Charity is probably what would be used. I think for the Christian, we would say, we should be able to say, a biblical understanding of justice doesn't have those national borders as very significant at all. Looks at the planet as a single entity. Looks at the total economy of the planet as a single entity. And ask questions about not just fellow U.S. citizens who are poor, but the poor of the earth. It asks questions about how can we provide access to economic opportunity in this country for people who aren't here yet or aren't legally here. It's very conscious of our own national history of immigrants, which almost all of us are. And talks about that in terms of justice. Yeah, I think that's true. But I don't think that'll sell in Congress. I don't think that'll get you legislation through Congress, that alone. To export our understanding of a democratic society may not be a blessing to everybody in the world. Yeah. As it isn't a blessing to everybody who's here. Others? Yeah.
When have we ever tried that?
Hmm?
When have we ever tried exporting our concept of democracy? I mean, my sense of what the U.S. has been about since the Second World War is that we have not supported any country that shared our ideas outside of Western Europe.
I think, Joan, we thought we were doing it at certain times. I think with the Philippines, we really believed that's what we were about in the earlier part of this century, that we were trying to turn the Philippines into an American-style democracy. I think that's what we thought we were doing. At least that's the mythology about it that you read when you go back. Well, but mythology is often very real. I mean, I think that was the common myth of the American public, as our politicians said, here's what we're about in the Philippines.
Well, yeah,
and I think the politicians
Vietnam,
believed it too.
They said that about Vietnam too.
Yeah. But, whether there was any ultimate reality to it or not, I think we often believed that that's what we were doing. And I think other peoples in the world also believed and looked to us as a kind of model of what they wanted to become. We still hear this. We go to Central America today and people say, why do you export to us your worst? Why don't you give us your best values? They admire those as they understand them. But they don't admire what we're currently doing with them. I don't know, maybe it'll take some more passage of time before we can come to any kind of conclusion about that, what America has been up to in the world. But I think in the early part of the 20th century, we really believed that that's what we were doing, was trying to create democratic societies like our own in other parts of the world where we had influence, even if we had to send the Marines in.
Right.
Anybody want to talk about Groundhog Day or Candlemas? Yeah, John.
I was interested in the comment you made earlier, and I wanted to see if you had any follow-up comment on the hue and cry regarding compassion on the political front today, which says that those whom compassion extended must be deserving of it, if we think of our welfare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Public assistance and so forth. What do I want to ask about that? Should the attitudes be
first of all, how do you react to that circumstance and the assumption that compassion handed about indiscriminately causes harm to those who receive it? And is there any parallel in the compassion extended in the name of Christ? Should the two be extended in a similar way, or are the two very different?
Well, that's a really complicated set of questions. Let me try to just sort of ramble in response to a number of things you said. One I think we have to be very careful about is the general tendency today to say that charity should be done by the private sector only, like the churches and people who want to do that kind of thing, but don't use taxpayer dollars to do what folks call charity. Use taxpayer dollars to buy weapons and so on, but not to do public assistance. I mean, nobody is pressing for that clean a distinction, but you hear that kind of talk. At one point, early in his first administration, Ronald Reagan said all of the poor in the United States could be taken care of if every church adopted 10 of them. That's the arithmetic he came up with. Which may be true. The assumption was that, A, that was the best way to do it. They aren't the responsibility of the whole society, but of the churches. And B, that every church could take care of 10. And my thought about that was the churches I know, including the one I currently belong to, would be maybe willing to try that for a while, but we'd lose interest after a while. And that's why I think you need things like Social Security and taxpayer shared responsibility for those who are least able to care for themselves. Another comment I have is, I think the biblical view of the poor is that all of the people who are not poor have a responsibility to meet the needs of the poor, no matter who the poor are, no matter what they're like, what their character is, has no bearing on it whatever. They are the responsibility of the non-poor simply because they're poor. And there's never a question raised about whether they're deserving or not. The other thing that I would hasten to add immediately is the main problem, I think, for the poor in our present system is the creation of dependency. Because I don't think that's a biblical idea, that the poor should forever stay poor and dependent on the non-poor. The poor should become non-poor themselves. They should be helped to attain self-sufficiency. And I think that's the main problem with the current public assistance programs. We haven't yet found a way to have them function so that the poor who are able to get work can get work, and the poor who are able to become non-poor can be assisted to become non-poor. And the same is true in the international scene with poor and rich nations. The poor nations are still dependent in the global economy on the non-poor. So I think that's the main problem that public policy has to address. How do you get out of the dependency trap internationally and domestically with families? And I think that's the welfare reform debate that is worth engaging in, how to break dependency. But I don't think any talk about who deserves public assistance and who doesn't is appropriate biblically. It'll probably always be true in the political arena, because that's the way people talk in the political arena. But for a biblical people, we shouldn't buy into that kind of discussion very heavily, I think, among ourselves. Because one who is poor is deserving, just because that person is poor, biblically viewed. Yeah, Joan?
I think.
And you can say that and agree to that without glorifying poverty, mm-hmm. without saying, therefore, let them stay in poverty, because look at what marvelous teachers they are of the rest of us. I guess what I've been wrestling with lately is a kind of middle ground in, let me first state what I think are the two extremes, that Christians tend to go one way or the other toward the extremes. One traditional Christian response to poverty is to say, well, we need to be more generous, we need to be more charitable, we need to do more individual work with people, lifting them out of poverty, or at least keeping them alive in poverty. And the other extreme is to say there will always be poor people until we change the economic system, until we do a macro revision. Get rid of capitalism is a favored way for some Christians from the left to say, we've got to get rid of the evils of capitalism first. And until we do that, we'll still have poor people, and therefore we have to do the big macroeconomic change. I think if you look at the Catholic Bishop's letter, some of you may have read that, you've certainly read about it. It pretty much rejects the first as the response. There is a need for continuing charity, but that's not the ultimate solution. And it tends to go toward the left, I think, in its prescription of change in the economic system. And they're talking about the national and international system. And I think that's probably true. I'm comfortable with that. But I don't want to wait for that to happen, because I think that's going to be a long way off. It seems to me there's something in between those two options. It's a third option that we haven't done very much with. And that would be to use even church resources, but certainly general community resources, for community economic development at the grassroots level, in the neighborhood. Assisting community development to provide jobs for people, to generate better housing for people, not through some federal program or international economic change, but through grassroots efforts that are possible within the present economic system. Community economic development at the grassroots or neighborhood level is a growing phenomenon in our society. A lot of people who are activists and used to be calling for macroeconomic change are now putting their energies that way. Elmer Jody Kretzman is one of those who's working in that area. And I really think they're onto something. What does it mean for the church? I think for the church it means for Christians collectively who have resources through the church in our society, we do have resources, economic resources, that we ought to be willing to use some of the church's money, including pension funds, to provide investment, to provide loans for community economic development. And that means taking some risks, because while many of them are very successful, when that money flows into poverty communities and there is good organization and good administration of it, and that's another thing the church can provide. We're just rich with people who know how to manage money, and know how to manage and organize economic development things. They tend not to be the poor. They are our manager class. But we have them, and we can provide that in addition to money. But when it is done well, 99 times out of 100, it succeeds. It returns the investment. But we'd have to run the risk of that one time in 100 when it wouldn't. And we'd have to provide a way of not taking that out of the pension benefits of the church's employees. I understand all that. My point is, the church has economic resources. Local churches, if they wanted to, could mortgage their property. If they're debt-free, and most of them are today, they could mortgage their property in order to raise capital for community economic development in their neighborhoods or across town. Very few local churches even think that way, but there's nothing to stop them from doing it. To take out a loan for which the collateral is their property. We do it all the time to build more buildings for the church. We could also do it to provide capital for community economic development. Individual church members who want to do good while doing well could put their money in a pool. No one of us individually knows how to do that, but we could have a structure set up that would let us put some of our own investment in socially responsible investing named community economic development. There are various ways that church resources in a fairly affluent church community could provide funds for capital. What poor communities need more than anything else is capital from outside. Their experience is that money leaves their communities. They need to have money coming in to generate jobs, to generate economic activity, and housing and all sorts of things. I think that's a kind of middle ground between these other two, that the way you respond to the poor is with charity, keeping individuals going, or the way you respond to the poor is redo the economic system first. We can't wait for that, and that may not happen for a good long time. What's in the middle? I think what's in the middle is community economic development.
The other thing I'm seeing to my sense of compassion, something beyond just, you know, economic, beyond just kind of serving, it seems to me to be on a more personal level too, in terms of risking and becoming involved and
kind
of some of your reflections on some of that. Some of what I've stirred some of my thought of someone's way, but by Henry Allen in terms of the, you know, crossing over the, and developing relational sorts of things, as well as, the development sorts of economic and external sorts of things. But the risking to know and to become known. My experience in church, sometimes very difficult for a church to invite the poor into that church. They're used to a very a certain sort of style, and to invite the poor into your church. Well, let's serve them over there. And it's very risky. It's pushing their comfort zones.
It's following our culture's values about who is important and worthy. And our culture basically says the poor are not worthwhile people. And that comes into the church and infects it and infects us. I remember a few, not too long ago, less than 2 years ago, hearing of a congregation in Iowa that had asked its congregational president to step aside from that post. He was not incapacitated. He hadn't moved out of the community. He was still able to function very well. Why did they ask him to resign? Because he was a farmer who had filed bankruptcy. And the congregation felt that it was a bad mark for them to have a president who had was going through bankruptcy. He had failed. He was a failure. And you don't want a congregational president who's a failure, as the culture views him. Well, that says a great deal about how we in the church often view ourselves, what our self-image is. We are so threatened by having leadership who are viewed in the community as failures that we want to get them out of positions of leadership. I mean, I think that's a telling anecdote about a lot of things. That was the only reason they asked him to step aside.
Don't you think that also describes our system of justice? Maybe.
Yeah.
It seems to me our human justice is pretty selfish. I mean, I look at a lot of people and their attitudes toward getting a piece of the pie, or, you know, that they deserve something just on a platter. And it seems that that's really not justice at all. I mean, there's no love in that kind of justice.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with your middle ground. Is that I have a feeling that whether you intend it or not, people would use it to make compassion nice.
Community economic development.
Right. I mean, that point to do it that way, because that's really not doing a lot of threatening and all that stuff. Would our Lord say someday, how come you didn't have the pension fund?
How come you didn't take risks with it?
Mm.
Yeah.
I chuckled when you said, well, of course, we have to take the pension fund.
Well, yeah, that's a good question in itself for debate. I think one reason is that's what the law requires the trustees to do, and the trustees are going to resign if you say you've got to break the law here or thumb your nose at the law.
About the pensioners.
But I think it really goes back, Elmer, to that.
Yeah.
Are the pensioners and future pensioners, who include you and me and thou,
right,
are we willing to have our retirement benefits dealt with in that risky way?
And now where is compassion?
And you and I might say, yeah, we're willing, but can we get a majority of our colleagues? I don't know. But that's an important question.
Another piece of sacred ground is endowments.
Yeah.
And I would love to talk about putting your secure term. Saving up our treasures. I mean, you know, I don't know what to do with that one, but I think there needs to be some real look at how the church deals with endowments and sets aside money, which then we let it sit there and we use the interest perhaps, but if that amount of money was used, and in fact, some of the stuff that's being done in Boston, taking endowments and using them for loans.
Yeah, well, that's one area that I think we should look at seriously. Why not use our endowments? Some local churches have endowments. Why not use our endowments to benefit the poor through community economic development, and at least using the interest that way, rather than depending on the endowments to sustain the ongoing budget of the congregation.
And there are some examples of that being done.